Yeah, so today I'm talking about the Desert Mothers. Do we all know about the Desert Mothers? Oh, okay, excellent. So lots to learn today. Well, who were they? The Desert Mothers were... they came about between the 4th and the 6th centuries when a number of Christians abandoned the cities of the Mediterranean to adopt an ascetic lifestyle in the deserts of Egypt and Syria. This was particularly so after Emperor Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And at that time, there were some major doctrinal issues being debated. For those with a theology degree, this is Arianism, which is about the nature of Christ and Christ's relationship to God the Father. And there were also questions being raised about those people who had fled persecution at that time, who wanted to now come back to the church and how they should be treated. So the people who went to the desert, they may have been lamenting the secularisation of Christianity and believed it was too easy to become a Christian and not take the spiritual discipline seriously. Or they may have been seeking refuge from those controversies, believing that living a Christian life was more important than debating doctrine, a la my friend Peter Oliver. there were three basic forms of desert life. Some desert dwellers were solitaries who essentially lived alone, though they might occasionally welcome visitors to share hospitality and provide spiritual guidance. Many spent years or even decades living in one room or a cave, seeing only a few people who would provide food and water. Others lived in clusters of huts or cells, close enough to worship together whilst being in solitude most of the time. Most, and this is particularly for the Desert Mothers, lived in structured communities or monasteries, and in fact, this is the beginning of monasticism. By the end of the 4th century, there are tens of thousands of men and women living in the desert. They didn't often write their thoughts down, however, over time, other people did. Many had their lives recorded in autobiographies known as the life of so-and-so to serve as an inspiration. And in these stories, the historical facts of their lives were less important than what they had said and done. The Desert Mothers were referred to as Amma and the Desert Fathers as Abba. Many had actually been highly educated and came from well-to-do families, but there were some who had come from lives of poverty. So what was life like for the Desert Mothers? Well, the desert life was essentially about one's inner journey with God. This is a journey that might be 1 metre long but many kilometres deep. It was a journey to self-awareness, which in turn led to a deeper understanding of God. It involved confronting what the Desert Mothers called demons or anything that distracted a person from their relationship with God. Obstacles such as unhelpful attitudes, motives, thoughts, emotional ties or concern for reputation that could complicate their inner journeys. And distractions could be more obvious too. It is said that for 60 years, Amma Sarah lived beside a river and never lifted her eyes to look at it. This was a life characterised by simplicity and asceticism. The Ammas gave their possessions away to pursue abundant simplicity and enjoy the abundance of God's presence. Possessions were reduced to a minimum, a sleeping mat, some clay jars, books and just the clothing on their bodies. They practiced self-denial, eating simpler and less appetizing foods, having just enough sleep on a sufficient but not necessarily comfortable bed, and prayers spread throughout the day. And they performed manual labour around the monasteries. The mothers believed they could have a greater direct experience of the divine presence if they were attached to fewer distractions, but they were also careful not to practice the asceticism to excess, as this too would have become a distraction from God. The Ammas were deeply compassionate people. They showed tender love and practical care for the poor and dispossessed. Having compassion helped them understand the struggles of others, see themselves in others, and remove any sense of distance or distinction. They rejected any judgmental or critical attitude and cultivated a healthy humility. They truly believed that Christ dwelt within the soul of every person, so every encounter with another was a meeting with God. All guests were received with a deep sense of hospitality. A fast or silence could be broken to share with the visitor, who might then be encouraged to also sit in silence in the presence of God. The Desert Mothers valued suffering, which they believed was grounded in an attachment to attitudes, thoughts, motives and reputation, believing that suffering would remain until a person let go of them. Prayer was a continuous way of life in the desert and practiced until it became second nature. Praying the Psalms, intercession, contemplation and silent awareness of God's presence were the main expressions of prayer. Psalms were recited throughout the day and into the night as well, if possible. It was a bodily experience. It was felt in the gut. And a rigid approach of understanding scripture was rejected. Amma Theodora warned her followers they'd be attacked by a sense of boredom or dejection, inviting them to be tenacious in prayer and trust one's original desire for God so that the boredom would pass. Silence was as intrinsic to the desert journey as prayer. Not just the absence of words, but an inner calm and serenity grounded in strength to allow the whispering of God to be heard. Being silent's difficult. Have you ever noticed how long the 1 minute silence feels during a remembrance service? We're inherently uncomfortable with silence. And the difficulties we have with being silent or solitary are not to do with companionship, but avoiding any real encounter with our own identity. In stillness, the truth can be seen. The desert dwellers strove to sit quietly and be fully attuned to the silence, allowing it to speak its wisdom, because silence is essentially listening. Mother Teresa was once interviewed about her prayer life. She was asked, "What do you say to God?" She replied, "I don't say anything, I just listen." "And what does God say?" she was asked. "God doesn't say anything, God just listens. And if you don't understand that, I can't explain it to you." So sitting in silence forces us to endure our own dark night of the soul. We fear confronting those aspects of ourselves that are unpalatable, embarrassing, hurting. We fear looking into our inner selves and finding that actually there isn't very much there. For the Ammas, spiritual listening involved intense listening for the voice of God. They immerse themselves in scripture and sacred writings to cultivate their minds and hearts for the silent mystery that is God. Their spiritual practices deepen their self-awareness. As their interior freedom deepened, their false sense was removed and a clearer understanding of their truest self emerged, the true self that dwells deeply with God. The desert mothers show us that getting to know our true selves involves getting to know ourselves in our frailties, facing our own hurt and anger, and revealing our idols. The goal of the desert journey was to overcome the inner struggle against inordinate attachments. Strong emotions like anger, fear, or anxiety did not dominate or control them, but were disciplined to serve that inner journey. And one can imagine the desert mothers praying the psalm we heard earlier from Psalm 131. "O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and marvellous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. My soul is like the weaned child that is with me." The inner journey of the desert dwellers strove constantly to live out those words, being humble, not being concerned with anything that could possibly distract a person from God. They had to wean their souls from their false selves, or risk not being detached enough to truly know God. And the desert mothers also remind me of Moses, who's also in the desert in that reading, and he's desperate to see God. He has just implored God to ensure that God's presence goes with the Israelites on their journey to the promised land. God reassures Moses that it will, but that's not enough. Moses asks to see God's glory, but bearing in mind just before this story, God's been appearing as a pillar of salt at the entrance of Moses' tent to talk with him, as well as having already performed countless signs and miracles. But God replies, "You cannot see my face, for no one shall see me and live. See, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of a rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." When I think of the desert mothers, I imagine them seeking God's glory, beseeching God to ensure that God's presence goes before them. It's something we all yearn for, but the desert dwellers managed to shape their whole lives just to come close to that moment where they could grasp, however tenuously, that sense of God's glory. In a literal sense, many of them lived in the cleft of a rock. They were living examples to others of striving to be covered with God's hand and have an assurance of living in God's presence. Pilgrims often sought out the desert mothers seeking a word from God. There are many stories of desert mothers who found they were seeing too many people to be solitary and moved further into the desert to regain that solitude. The sayings the desert mothers gave to pilgrims were passed along trade routes, bearing in mind this was a largely oral culture. and came to be associated with certain people, and were written down from about the 5th century. These are generally short, pithy sayings that encapsulated a biblical truth and exhorted the listener to examine themselves. And we're going to listen to some of those now. Some of you in the congregation have them. And can we start from this end, if you could just read them out?
My trainer. We carry ourselves wherever we go, and we cannot escape temptation by mere flight.
Emma Synclectica.
I think it's Synclectica. I don't know.
Do not let yourselves be seduced by the delights of the riches of the world, as though they contain something useful on account of a vain pleasure. Worldly people esteem the culinary art, but you, through fasting and thanks to cheap food, go beyond their abundance of food. It is written, one who is sated loathes honey. Proverbs 27:7. Do not fill yourselves with bread, and you will not desire wine.
If you find yourself in a monastery, do not go to another place, for that will harm you a great deal. Just as the bird abandons the egg she was sitting on prevents them from hatching, so the monk or the nun grows cold and their faith dies when they go to another place.
Emma Synclectica of Egypt. In the beginning of our spiritual journey, there are a great many battles and a good deal of suffering for those who are advancing towards God, and afterwards, ineffable joy. It is like those who wish to light a fire. At first they are choked by the smoke and cry, and by this means they obtain what they seek. As it is said, our God is a consuming fire, Hebrews 12:24. So we also must kindle the divine fire in ourselves through tears and hard work.
Sarah, it is good to give alms for people's sake, even if it is done only to please others. Surely one will begin to seek to please God.
Anna Sarah, if I prayed that all people should approve of my conduct, I should find myself a penitent at the door of each one, but I shall rather pray that my heart may be pure to the Lord.
Amma Matryna. Many people living secluded lives on a mountain have perished by living like people in the world. It is better to live in a crowd and want to live a solitary life than to live a solitary life, but all the time belonging to
company. And isn't it interesting that even though these were written, I can't even calculate how many centuries ago, they're still relevant. The human condition persists, nothing new under the sun. There are also stories written about the desert mothers to instruct others, and I'm going to read one now about a desert mother called Marina. And her story was designed to show that the desert dwellers believed it was better to suffer false accusations and attacks in silence than to accuse somebody else of lying. In the 5th century, Marina was raised and educated by her father, Eugenius. When she was old enough to be married, Eugenius announced that he was going to give all his wealth to her, to Marina, and become a desert ascetic. Marina refused to be left behind and followed her father into the desert. So that she could enter the same monastery as her father, she shaved her head, wore men's clothing, and changed her name to Marinos. And in fact, many of the desert mothers were people who presented to monasteries as eunuchs. So this wasn't necessarily unusual. Marina developed a reputation for hard work and spiritual maturity. She lived with her father in his cave until his death, and no one suspected she was a woman. One day, the abbot sent Marina with some other men to visit some monasteries, some monks. On the journey, they stayed at an inn. Whilst they were there, a soldier seduced the innkeeper's daughter and told her that if she became pregnant, she should accuse Marina. This is indeed what happened. The innkeeper's daughter became pregnant, accused Marina, and her father came to the monastery to inform the abbot. On her return from the journey, Marina accepted the accusation and begged forgiveness, never revealing her identity. She was expelled from the monastery, but Marina stayed right outside the gates. She took responsibility and cared for the baby boy who had been brought to her. They lived outside the monastery gate for 4 years, during which time she continually confessed her sin of fornication to anyone who passed by and requested repeatedly permission to return to the community. She was eventually allowed to return to the monastery, where she resumed her life of simplicity and austerity. It was only at her death that the community realised she was a woman. How is that for an example of forbearance? There is much we can learn from the example and the wisdom of the desert mothers. But I wish to suggest to you that there's much we can learn from the desert. And indeed, in recent years, we've seen the development of a theology of the desert. Would it have been the same for the desert mothers to live lives of asceticism in rooms in the city? I can't help but think that the desert itself is a symbol of their journey. It's harsh, uncomfortable, desolate, does not furnish us with ease at all. I remember reading a book many years ago called Walk in the Bible by Bruce Feiler, in which he traces the geography of the first five books of the Bible. And he remarked that to understand the Bible, you need to understand the desert. And I think Paul has a good sense of that in those songs today. And it makes sense when you think of the key moments in Judeo-Christian history that have occurred in the desert. And just to check that you're all awake, we'll have a pop quiz. Throw me some moments, some stories from the Bible that are desert-based. See what we can think of. The Exodus, yep. It's a key one. Yep, temptation of Jesus, yep. Any others? Elijah, yep. Oh, yep, John the Baptist, yep. Yep, travels of Abram and Sarah. Joseph in Egypt, the famine. Any others anyone can think of? Key moments, anyway, in our shared history. But what does the desert mean to us in Australia today? As a people, we gather at the edges of our country. Many of us will never venture into the interior or have much contact with a desert that covers actually most of the continent. And in thinking about these questions, it brought to mind friends of mine who also attend Star Street, who have actually lived in the desert and whose lives embody many of the qualities of what I am going to call modern desert dwellers. Some of you may know them, my friends Cameron and Louise Tiro. And I approached Cameron to see if he'd be happy for me to share his experience of the desert with you, and he just about burst out of his skin. he was very delighted to do so, so I have his permission, and he would have been here himself if he could have. So he and Louise worked as school teachers in a homelands community called Dukala. It's not written like that, but they say Dukala. And that's actually where they met. Dukala is in, and again, forgive the pronunciation, Nanyajara area, which also takes in Warrakoona and the Warburton Ranges. And these lands cover parts of the Gibson, the Great Sandy and Victoria deserts. It's actually 250,000 square kilometres, or 3% of the landmass of Australia. Dukala is actually quite close to the border of the Northern Territory, not too far in terms of Australian distance from Uluru. Can you imagine anywhere more remote? so they had about 100 to 200 people living there, depending on the time of the year. And so these are the questions I asked Cam. What does the desert sound like? It's silent, but it's alive with the sound of birds. Thunder in the summer, though it rarely rains. The most common sound is of people, mostly women, calling out to each other. Joyous yelling in language, excited, funny, telling kids off or to come, sometimes angry. What does the desert smell like? It's sweaty. It was said that you knew you'd been on country long enough when the sweat pools on the top of your stomach. So for the men, sort of, yeah. And the smell of rain on dry earth. What does a desert look like? It's red and blue and gold. It's beautiful. The desert seems to be a space of nothingness, but actually it's full of life, culture, stories, songlines, landscape, vegetation, animals. And Cam pointed out that it's in the wilderness that many of the world's unique cultures have been able to preserve their identities, and we would do well to learn the wisdom of those cultures that have remained intact. Another West Australian you may know, Dr. Ian Robinson, also has a keen interest in desert spirituality and leads groups on desert experiences. He believes that Australians fear the desert. Its vast silence challenges our layers of rationality, our highly structured sense of civilization and safety. This is where we have much to learn from our Aboriginal brothers and sisters. Miriam Rose Ungenmer Bauman is an artist, a tribal elder and educator who has written on this topic. She said the most unique gift her people can give their fellow Australians is a quality called dadiri, or dadiri. I'm about to read her words speaking about her people. Dadiri is an inner, deep listening and quiet, still awareness. Dadiri recognises the deep spring that is inside us. We call on it and it calls to us. This is the gift Australia is thirsting for. It is something like what you call contemplation. When I experience dadiri, I am made whole again. I can sit on the riverbank or walk through the trees. Even if someone close to me has passed away, I can find my peace in this silent awareness. There is no need of words. A big part of dadiri is listening. Through the years, we've listened to our stories. They are told and sung over and over as the seasons go by. Today, we still gather around the campfires and together we hear the sacred stories. As we grow older, we ourselves become the storytellers. We pass on to the young ones all they must know. The stories and songs sink quietly into our minds and we hold them deep inside. In the ceremonies, we celebrate the awareness of our lives as sacred. The contemplative way of dadiri spreads over our whole life. It renews us and brings us peace. It makes us feel whole again. In our Aboriginal way, we learnt to listen from our earliest days. We could not live good and useful lives unless we listened. This was the normal way for us to learn, not by asking questions. We learnt by watching and listening, waiting and then acting. Our people have passed on this way of listening for over 40,000 years. There is no need to reflect too much and do a lot of thinking. It's just being aware. My people are not threatened by silence. They are completely at home in it. They have lived for thousands of years with nature's quietness. My people today recognise and experience in this quietness the great life-giving spirit, the father of us all. It is easy for me to experience God's presence. When I'm out hunting, when I'm in the bush, among the trees, on a hill or by a billabong, these are the times when I can simply be in God's presence. I thought the Aboriginal concept of dadiri seems very similar to the desert mother's inner journey. And there is much for us to learn from both ideas. It is indeed their gift to us. Well, by the end of the 5th century, Roman power was declining. The desert had become a dangerous place to live. Bands of raiders swept in from the deserts to devastate the monasteries. Many desert dwellers moved to safer areas, while others stayed and were martyred. The era of the desert dwellers, the desert mothers, had ended. They continue to be commemorated in their feast days, and their legacy speaks strongly to us across the centuries in an era and culture where we say we crave simplicity, yet continue to fill our lives with excess and busyness. And I have to confess that with my recent work and family commitments, it was such an effort to find time to write the sermon. It's like, oh, how am I going to write the sermon? About simplicity. So let me assure the irony was not lost on me. But what can we personally take from the example of the desert mothers? Are there possessions we can give away to unclutter our homes? Can we make time to sit in silence and simply listen? Be aware. Can we take active steps to live more simply and have richer relationships? What would it take for us to be able to honestly speak those words of Psalm 131? O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvellous for me. I have calmed and quieted my soul. So I thought it would be helpful to have some silence. It seemed fitting. However, I'm also happy if people have questions, whatever you think you want to do at this point. Shall we have some silence? Oh, sorry, Peter, yep.
Oh. I'm just wondering what you think. For me, the idea of hermitry is tremendously tempting. but I don't find it in Jesus' teaching. Get away for a time, yes, sure. But, you know, you need to be back where the people are and you need to be a witness, you need to be serving others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I find.
Yep. And I guess, it isn't really, yeah, I agree with you. But there's still things I think we can learn that the people who have chosen to do that, and even people who do that now, who live in monasteries and who live a life of constant prayer, that constant rhythm of life, I've always felt that that is for a reason and a purpose. If that's their purpose, if they feel that's God's purpose in their lives, what do we then learn from them? I agree, it wouldn't work if that was for everybody. Yep. And I think the fact that pilgrims went out, people made an effort to go and see them, they became sort of teachers, I guess, in their own way, organically. But yes, that's a good point.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
You talked about Christian desert communities. What was the connection with communities like the Qumran community that was actually pre-Christian?
Good question. I don't have an answer for that. That would be a very interesting topic. As in the Riders of Q and...
It sounds like they did something very similar.
Yeah, yep. I imagine they did. Yeah, so I guess the desert lifestyle, and I guess that's why it's interesting to relate it to Aboriginal people in Australia as well, that this is a way of being for some people from which we can take comfort and learn. Yeah.
Was there anything distinctive about desert mothers in terms of the gender-based message that you saw as distinctive from, say, the desert fathers?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, less was written down from what they said, so in some ways we don't have a very clear picture of that. So I don't feel able to really respond here. Oh, one thing they actually, having now think about it, the desert mothers were referred to as the godly men. Like they were like, yeah, yeah, they were the, yeah. They were considered, it was meant to be a compliment that they were light men. Yeah. So that, it's more about the times, I guess, sadly.
And thank you very much. You might have already alluded to it, but I'm interested just what it's, you've talked a little bit about disclosed a little bit about yourself. I don't know a lot about you, and you're obviously
sure.
A mother and have other things happening in your life, which I guess is similar to a lot of people. What's the real take home, the thing that you're really getting from this that's really useful for you, for example?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, there's so many. I'm a shocker for this. And I think I've always been drawn to the people who live in silence, to the people who have simple, uncluttered lives, because that is so different to what I do. So for me, it's just trying to live a more simple life. It's less busy, particularly. And that time of just having awareness of what's around me rather than going and going and going. So that's personally what I feel, but I imagine that's quite a common experience in Western culture. Is that enough detail? Yeah, so for me, and the nature of the work that I do can be hard to set limits on it, and having children who have activities or just needing to spend time with, there's always something. And I had a week just a few weeks ago that was just so comically busy, like in the end it was laughable, that I didn't have there was not one spare hour in the week. It was just ridiculous. So that's why this has been a helpful exercise for me.
Something, when you were talking about the choice of sort of staying centred and then action coming out of that, and I've just been reading a book by Thomas Keating called The Better Part, and it's about contemplative spirituality, but he basically talks about the Mary-Martha duality, where Mary chooses the better part because she actually listens first.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that you listen first and then you act, whereas I tend to do it the other way around. So I'm trying to practice listening, but just the daily challenge of just shutting up and being quiet is... Thank you. Thank you for that encouragement.
Jen, just a simple question. Where did the stories that you've been talking about this morning and the quotations, where's the book or where did they come from?
So that one, those were mostly from a book called The Forgotten Desert Mothers, which, and I have a copy of it to show people if they're interested. There's a much more greater awareness now of the role of desert mothers as opposed to the desert fathers. But this book does provide a very good overview of the historical context and what they said.